Welcome in, everybody. And I mean a specific welcome to you, the listener, tuning in today. If you're here with us, chances are you appreciate a really good story. But more importantly, you appreciate digging into the hidden mechanics of how a successful life is actually built.
Absolutely.
So, okay, let's unpack this. Today, we are embarking on a journey that completely, and I mean totally, shatters the illusion of the perfect straight-line career path.
Right.
This is part one of a special three-part deep dive into the life and just wildly unconventional trajectory of Taurus Wolf, the founder of Wolf Architects. And let me just set the parameters right up front.
Yeah, that's important.
This is not a standard dusty biography. Yeah. You're not just going to sit here and read off a resume of dates and architectural awards.
Yeah, no one wants that.
Right. We're here to explore a story about a career path that is the exact opposite of a straight line. It's about how someone became a master of their craft by doing, well, almost everything except following the traditional rules. Today, we are focusing on the first four chapters of his story from our source material. The section is aptly titled Forging the Architect Within.
It's a really brilliant place to start. And frankly, it's a completely necessary foundation for understanding everything that comes later in his life.
For sure.
What's fascinating here is the specific metaphor that Taurus himself uses to frame this entire narrative. The sources highlight that over two decades ago, when Taurus finally found a permanent place to call home, one of the very first things he did was plant a tree.
Yeah.
But he didn't plant a pine tree or an oak. He planted a Chinese elm.
And for those of us who, you know, aren't botanists, what is the actual significance of the Chinese elm?
Well, think about a pine tree. It grows straight up. It has a single, predictable, vertical trunk just aiming directly for the sky.
Right.
And that is how most of us are taught a career should look. But a Chinese elm grows wildly. Over 20 years, this specific tree that Taurus planted didn't just go up. Its branches stretched out in every possible, unpredictable direction.
Wow.
It twisted, it turned, it created this massive, complex, interwoven canopy. Taurus looks at that tree and sees a literal reflection of his own life. So this deep dive today, focusing on his early years, is the story of those early chaotic branches. It's the story of the detours, the dead ends, and the wild tangents.
I love that metaphor so much because, yeah. Let's be honest, society is just constantly demanding that we walk that predictable straight pine tree line.
Always.
You go to school, you get good grades, you go to a respectable university, land the entry-level job, climb a ladder, and boom, you retire.
The standard script.
Exactly.
Exactly.
But Taurus's story proves that unexpected detours and closed doors and moments of just sheer scrappy independence actually forge true creative independence. And I want to connect this directly to you, the listener, right now. How often do you feel pressured to follow a traditional path? How often do you feel like a misstep or a detour in your own life is a permanent failure? This deep dive is your official permission slip to embrace the detours, because sometimes the detour is the actual destination.
Precisely. The detour provides the raw material for the professional you're becoming. So to understand the canopy of this Chinese elm, we really have to examine the roots.
Take us there.
We are starting in 1970s Thailand. Now, Taurus is born in Australia, but his family relocates, and he's raised in Thailand from infancy. He's navigating the world with a dual nationality. He's half Asian, half Caucasian. His father's Thai and Chinese. His mother is Australian. And here is a really crucial detail from the sources.
What's that?
His dominant primary language is Thai. He actually speaks Thai before he speaks English.
Which naturally dictates his early schooling. Because he spoke Thai first, his parents enrolled him in a local all-Thai kindergarten.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to set the cultural stage here. Bangkok in the 1970s is this rapidly developing city, but it's still highly traditional in a lot of ways.
Very much so.
And being what was termed a half-child, a child of mixed Western and Asian descent, meant that he stood out instantly and constantly.
He did. Now, the sources are very careful to clarify this. He wasn't physically bullied. He wasn't getting beaten up on the playground.
Right.
But there was this profound subconscious feeling of insecurity and isolation. He was physically smaller. His features looked vastly different from everyone else in his class. And that created an invisible but impenetrable barrier.
Kids pick up on that stuff.
Children are incredibly perceptive to differences. His parents eventually recognized this friction and made the pivotal decision to pull him out of the local system and place him exclusively into English-speaking international schools.
A big shift.
A huge shift. But that initial isolation left a permanent psychological arc. If we connect this to the bigger picture, This profound childhood isolation really turned him into what he terms a lone wolf.
It's a fitting moniker, and it wasn't just his school environment contributing to it. His home life compounded that isolation big time.
Yeah.
He had no siblings until he was 7 years old. So for the critical formative years of early childhood, he's an only child. No friends to see outside of school hours, no cousins living nearby, no neighborhood kids to safely run around with on the streets of Bangkok. It was just him.
Yeah.
But what I find so compelling is that the text doesn't describe a miserable, weeping child. He wasn't sitting around feeling sorry for himself. He simply didn't have the time to be sad because his imagination was forced into absolute overdrive.
Isolation is often the absolute crucible for hypercreativity. Think about the era we're discussing here.
The 70s.
The 1970s. Toys and entertainment are scarce. Most television programming available to him is in black and white, and there is absolutely nothing broadcast in English.
Wow, right?
His exposure to the Western world, to pop culture, to standard childhood distractions is extremely limited. So what does a highly intelligent, isolated child do when the external world offers nothing?
They build their own.
Exactly. They build their own internal world. Drawing became his absolute sanctuary. But he wasn't sitting at a table drawing pretty bowls of fruit or tracing comic book characters. He was inventing. He was actively world building.
The tactile nature of this world building is fascinating. He was sketching these massive, sprawling battlefields, imagining intricate tanks and planes moving across terrains that he had entirely invented.
And he's physically making them too.
Yes. He wasn't just drawing them. He was constructing physical objects with his bare hands, using whatever scrap paper, tape, and glue he could find lying around the house. At an incredibly young age, he was teaching himself the fundamental mechanics of manifesting an idea.
Taking a concept from his mind and figuring out how to make it physically exist in the real world.
Exactly. In a world where he felt he didn't quite belong, he was simply making his own rules.
It is the earliest spark of architectural thinking. Not designing buildings, but designing systems and spaces.
Yeah.
And this brings us to a pivotal shift in his awareness.
Oh, this part is great.
Taurus's father, during this period, is transitioning his career to become a property developer. And to facilitate this, his father hires a full-time architect who sets up a workspace. 7-year-old Taurus begins watching this professional architect work. He is absolutely mesmerized.
But, and this is such a crucial distinction, he is not mesmerized by the architecture.
Not at all.
He couldn't care less about the buildings being designed. He is entirely obsessed with the gear, the architect's tools.
The magical tools as he viewed them.
Right, magical tools. He's looking at the drafting pencils, the massive slanted tables, the precision stencils, the scale rulers. To a 7-year-old boy building paper tanks, this wasn't about constructing commercial spaces for the real world. These were highly advanced tools that could help him draw his imaginary battlefields with infinitely more precision.
It's a beautiful distinction to make. The passion for the aesthetic, the mechanics of drawing, and the tactile feel of the tools preceded the passion for architecture itself. And this fascination led to a level of dedication that is frankly astonishing for a child his age. By the time he's 10 years old, he takes matters into his own hands. He saves up his own pocket money, leaves his house, walks 15 minutes alone through the bustling streets of Bangkok to a specific department store, and purchases his very first piece of professional equipment.
I really want to pause on this because the details are staggering. Okay. He buys a 0.1 millimeter Rotring drafting pen.
Yes.
Now, for the listener who might not be familiar with technical drawing pre-computers, a Rotring pen is not a ballpoint.
No, it's a completely different beast.
It is a highly sensitive, professional-grade technical pen that uses a tiny tubular nib to dispense India ink. A 0.1 millimeter nib is practically the thickness of a human hair.
It is so fragile.
It is the thinnest line possible. If you press too hard, it snaps.
Okay.
If you don't clean it meticulously, it clogs permanently. It requires immense discipline to use. And it cost him 500 base. In the early 1980s, that was roughly $20.
Which, for a 10-year-old kid at that time, is an absolute fortune.
It's astronomical. Imagine a 10-year-old today saving up a comparative amount of money, adjusting for inflation, maybe $50 or $60, and walking to a specialized art supply store.
Not for a video game.
No.
Oh.
Not to buy a toy, not for a remote control car, but to buy a highly technical, frustratingly delicate drafting pen. It demonstrates this intense, almost gravitational pull toward design. He starts doing his regular school homework with these professional drafting tools, obsessing over the line weight, dreaming of being an architect just so he can use the gear,
But this singular, blinding obsession comes with a very dark side.
Yeah, it really does.
The sources describe it as the great curse of knowing exactly what you want to be from a very young age. Because he was so hyper-focused on drawing, design, and the aesthetic presentation of his ideas, everything else in his academic life felt completely irrelevant. Exactly. His parents were highly career-focused and busy, so he didn't have a lot of strict parental supervision when it came to his nightly homework. Without that external discipline and lacking any internal motivation for standard subjects, he just drifted. He became what the text beautifully calls a creative ghost in the classroom.
A creative ghost. That is such a haunting, accurate way to put it. It implies he was physically occupying a desk, technically present in the room, but his intellect was just haunting the margins of his notebooks.
Yeah.
While the teachers are at the chalkboard droning on about historical dates or chemical formulas, Tortoise is mentally designing three-dimensional spaces or just illustrating intricate battlefields in his workbook. His mind is building cities while his body is stuck in middle school.
And unfortunately, the subject he was haunting the most, his absolute nemesis, was algebra.
Right, the universal dread of algebra. We've all been there.
Algebra becomes a recurring villain in this narrative. But in truth, all his subjects were suffering. He was getting terrible reports and poor grades across the board. And this is a universal friction point. The traditional educational system demands that a student be moderately good at a wide variety of standardized things.
Which he was not.
Terrace was exceptionally interested in only one very specific unstandardized thing. This raises an important question, perhaps for you as a listener to ponder. How does a rigid system handle a wildly unbalanced, hyper-creative individual?
Often, very poorly.
Poorly indeed. In this case, the school eventually sends a very firm, unavoidable letter to his parents. The message is crystal clear. He is failing, and he needs a much more disciplined, rigorous environment if he's going to make anything of himself.
A total wake-up call.
And this letter triggers a massive upheaval in his life.
A total geographical and cultural upheaval.
Yeah.
At 13 years old, his parents pack him up and send him off to boarding school. Specifically, the United World College, or UWC, in Singapore. Now, to a 13-year-old Taras, this is a literal jail sentence. He firmly believes he's being punished for his bad grades. He's heard all the classic horror stories about British-style boarding schools. The hazing, the bullying, the freezing showers, the rigid draconian rules.
The worst-case scenario in his head.
And to make matters worse, before he can even start his classes, UWC requires him to sit for a series of academic placement tests just to see where he stands.
And unsurprisingly, given his history of daydreaming and completely ignoring his classes in Bangkok, he bombs those placement tests spectacularly.
Oh, man.
Based on those results, the administration places him into the lowest possible academic tiers for almost all of his core subjects. Sitting in those bottom-tier classes was profoundly embarrassing for him.
I bet.
It was a tangible, public confirmation of his academic failure. But what's fascinating here is his reaction to that embarrassment. A lot of kids would internalize that, accept the label of being not smart, and just give up.
Yeah, they just lean into it.
Taras didn't shrink away. That intense, burning embarrassment became his absolute rocket fuel. He became fiercely, quietly determined to climb the academic ranks and prove them wrong.
And it turns out, UWC was actually the perfect incubator for that kind of determination. It was not the harsh, punitive prison he expected. UWC, for those unfamiliar, is a really unique educational movement. It's highly progressive, globally focused, and fosters a holistic culture of peace, mutual respect, and genuine curiosity.
It wasn't about breaking students down.
Exactly. It was about building global citizens. Surrounded by that kind of supportive, intellectually stimulating environment, Taras digs deep. He applies an incredible amount of self-discipline, and over his time there, he manages to drag his dismal C-minus average all the way up to a solid B+.
That is no small feat.
Not at all, especially for someone who previously couldn't pay attention for 5 minutes.
It is a remarkable academic turnaround. However, the social transition was significantly rockier. It took him at least a year to overcome his deep-seated insecurities, his lone wolf tendencies, and begin to form real friendships in the boarding house.
Right.
And it is during those vulnerable, highly volatile early days that he encounters a boy who would have a massive, unexpected impact on his life. Enter a student named Michael Liu.
Okay, I want to spend some time on Michael Liu because the dynamic here is so cinematic. Taras was quite small at 13. He's feeling out of place. Michael Liu is perhaps a year older, maybe 14, but physically, he is virtually a grown man.
Yeah, he's fully developed.
Puberty has completely finished its work. Michael is confident, he is handsome, he is highly intelligent, he is charismatic, and the sources specifically note that he was built like a young Bruce Lee.
A very intimidating presence.
He is the alpha of the environment. And when Terrace first arrives, Michael takes to teasing him quite a bit.
It was likely just standard, harmless, young teenage boy behavior, you know, texting boundaries, establishing a pecking order. But to Terrace, who is deeply homesick, academically frustrated, and feeling entirely out of his depth, it feels monumental. The pressure builds and builds.
One day, the pressure valve blows. Terrace just snaps. He's being teased, he can't take another second of it, and he hauls off and throws a punch straight at Michael Liu.
Oh, massive risk.
He throws a punch at the kid built like Bruce Lee. In that split second after his fist connects, Terrace fully expects to get completely destroyed in a massive brawl. He braces for the impact, thinking his life at the school is essentially over.
But the retaliation never comes.
No.
Michael does something completely unexpected, something that defies all the standard rules of teenage male ego. He simply walks away.
Yeah.
He absorbs the hit, looks at Terrace, and refuses to retaliate.
Wow. Just mind-blowing.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this moment of profound restraint absolutely short-circuits Terrace's brain. He had prepared for a physical fight, but he wasn't prepared for maturity.
That's a great way to put it.
The person he thought he despised in that heated, terrifying moment suddenly becomes someone he deeply admires. Michael's restraints set a completely new benchmark for Terrace regarding what true strength and confidence actually look like. From that day forward, they kept a very careful, respectful distance from one another, but the internal dynamic had completely shifted. His nemesis had unknowingly become his role model.
And that dynamic gets incredibly intense a couple of years later. Terrace is now 15 or 16. He's gearing up for his GCSEs, which are the major, highly stressful, standardized exams in the British educational system. And he has finally found his ultimate sanctuary at UWC.
Yes.
It's a class called Craft Design and Technology, or CDT. For Terrace, CDT is his kingdom. This is where he excels. This is where his childhood paper tanks and rotting pens finally translate into real academic success. He's the master of the workshop.
He's in his element.
Totally. But then, on the first day of the new term, who walks through the door to take the class? Michael Liu.
The alpha returns. Terrace's initial thought is pure dread. He thinks he is going to have to endure two entire years of this super cool, highly capable jock invading his one sacred space. He makes a silent vow right then and there. This is my turf. I will be the absolute king of this class. I will not be outdone here.
The stakes are suddenly huge.
But the twist in the narrative is that Michael Liu is not just athletic. He is incredibly talented at design and technical drawing as well. Michael quickly becomes the shining star of the CDT class, and this ignites a fierce, relentless, but highly constructive rivalry.
It is the ultimate push and pull. Every single time Terrace thinks he has designed something amazing, something cutting edge, Michael brings in a project that just pushes the envelope slightly further. They are quietly engaged in an arms race of design.
And it culminates at the end of the year?
Right. At the end of the year, they have to present their final models. Michael presents a cardboard architectural model, and the execution is so ridiculously precise, so flawless, that the teacher actually pulls him aside and asks if he hired a professional architect to build it.
The quality was just next level.
Insane.
But Terrace admits in hindsight that this exact rivalry is what pushed him to his absolute limits. They were constantly egging each other on through the quality of their work. If Michael hadn't been standing at the next workbench, setting that impossible standard, Terrace's work wouldn't have been nearly as refined. We also have to give immense credit to the teacher here, a man named Mr. Garrett.
Yes, Mr. Garrett is a crucial figure in this story.
A lesser educator might have sensed the tension and tried to separate them or squash the rivalry to keep the peace. Mr. Garrett recognized what was happening and nurtured it.
He leaned into it.
He did.
Yeah.
He was incredibly supportive and genuinely enjoyed watching these two highly driven students constantly surprise him with escalating, complex designs. It's a perfect real-world example of how the right environment, paired with the right kind of competition, can exponentially elevate someone's potential. Terrace poured his absolute heart and soul into his CDT portfolio. It ceased to be just schoolwork. It became a defining personal mission.
And the main project he designs for his portfolio is incredibly telling. He conceptualizes and meticulously drafts a house that features a beautiful, massive, living tree growing right through the exact middle of the structure.
A massive undertaking.
The entire home, the roofline, the floors, they're all designed to protect, embrace, and accommodate this living tree. Now, I want you, the listener, to bookmark that detail. A house built around a growing tree.
Definitely remember that.
Talk about subconscious foreshadowing. Keep that image in mind, because it is going to return in a major way later in his life story. It was a tangible reflection of his deep-seated desire to merge the organic with the structured.
And this profound success in CDT gave Taras a massive surge of baseline confidence. He knew he was good at something tangible, and you start to see his personality, his humor, bleeding into his other, much more rigid subjects.
Which I love.
He starts sneaking elaborate, highly detailed cartoons and humorous notes into the margins of his homework for math, English, and physics.
He's sitting there, looking at these dry equations, thinking, how can I break the monotony of this rigid grading process? How can I entertain myself and the teacher? It's a massive flex of his newfound confidence.
It really is.
He kept the cartoons out of his official exams, of course, unless he finished early, but it shows that he's finally finding his voice.
Mm-hmm.
He is no longer the embarrassed, defeated kid in the bottom tier remedial class. He has agency.
Yeah.
But as always in this story, right as things stabilize, a looming reality check arrives.
And the reality check is university admissions. As he approaches the end of his time at UWC, having completed his GCSEs, he begins looking at his future. He desperately wants to go to university in Melbourne, Australia, the city of his birth.
The ultimate goal.
He targets both RMIT and the University of Melbourne, which are highly competitive, world-class institutions. He sits down with the school's careers counselor and faces a very hard mathematical truth. Yes, bringing his grades up from a C- to a B+ is a massive personal achievement. But a B+ average is simply not going to get him into a premier architecture program. He needs straight A's. And worse, he is still dragging his absolute nemesis algebra behind him like an anchor.
So he realizes he needs a strategic detour. He calculates his options. If he stays at UWC in Singapore, his only path forward is the full International Baccalaureate, or IB, program.
Which is notoriously difficult.
The IB is incredibly rigorous, heavily focused on well-rounded academics, including advanced math, and due to the differences in international school calendars versus the Australian calendar, completing the IB would mean graduating a year and a half later than his peers in Australia.
He doesn't want to wait.
He decides he cannot wait that long, and he cannot risk his GPA on IB algebra. So what does he do? He decides to leverage his dual nationality, completely skip the IB program at UWC, and head straight to Melbourne to enter an Australian high school for year 11 and 12. He's hoping the different curriculum will allow him to secure those vital A grades.
It is a bold, highly strategic move. But this specific detour does not go according to plan. It is a classic, painful case of expectation versus reality.
Let's talk about the Mount Eliza meltdown. How does he even choose this new school?
Based almost entirely on a glossy promotional brochure and a single counselor's recommendation, we have to remember, this is the pre-internet era. You couldn't just look up student reviews on Reddit or take a virtual tour on YouTube. You had to trust the marketing material.
You just had to hope for the best.
Based on that brochure, he enrolls at Peninsula Grammar School in Mount Eliza, a suburb of Melbourne. He finishes his intense GCSE exams in tropical Singapore, and with absolutely zero summer break, he jumps on a plane and drops straight into the exact middle of year 11 in Australia.
It's an absolute recipe for disaster. The juxtaposition is jarring on every possible level. He leaves the bustling, humid, incredibly diverse, globally minded environment of UWC in Singapore and lands in a strict, uniform-wearing all-boys, overwhelmingly white, completely geographically isolated school in the middle of a freezing gray Melbourne winter.
A total shock to the system.
He later described Mount Eliza as feeling like it was in the middle of absolute nowhere.
The isolation is compounded by the timing. Joining any high school mid-year means the friendship groups are already deeply formed and impenetrable. Academically, the classes are already deep into localized material he hasn't learned. It is a massive, shocking cultural and academic disconnect.
And he tries to tough it out.
Yeah.
He endures this freezing, lonely environment for almost 3 months. That three-month period is the entirety of what should have been his restorative summer break after his GCSEs.
Just brutal.
The physical fatigue of continuous schooling and the mental fatigue of the culture shock just compound daily. And eventually his body and his mind just say no more. He hits a wall, a complete total meltdown.
The breaking point is small, but so relatable. He gets a head cold. For a highly driven student, a cold is usually something you just push through with some medication, but he has absolutely no willpower left. The tank is completely empty. He refuses to get out of bed in the boarding house. He just wants to pull the heavy blankets over his head and disappear from the world.
And the school's response lacks any empathy. A cleaner comes into his room, sees him in bed, yells at him for being lazy, and orders him to go report to the housemaster immediately.
Just kicking him while he's down.
He drags himself out of bed, gets a stern lecture about discipline, and in that moment, something inside him just breaks. He doesn't care about the rules anymore. He doesn't care about the A grades. He is entirely broken. He manages to get to a payphone, calls his parents in Bangkok, and they can hear the utter hollow defeat in his voice. Mm. They realize the severity of the situation and offer him an immediate lifeline. Come back home to Thailand.
Which represents another incredible pivot in his journey. He cannot return to UWC in Singapore because his enrollment there has lapsed and he abandoned their curriculum. He cannot stay in Australia. So he returns to Thailand and enrolls at the International School of Bangkok, commonly known as ISB.
So just to recap for the listener, he has now transitioned to a third vastly different high school system with literally no break in between.
Exactly. But the environment at ISB is the polar opposite of Mount Eliza. It changes everything.
He describes ISB as pure 1980s Americana. He says walking the halls was like a mix of Pretty in Pink, The Breakfast Club, and Beverly Hills 90210.
A total culture shock in a good way.
There are neon lockers, sports jackets, people driving cars to school. It is this intoxicating culture of American freedom that he had never, ever experienced in the rigid, rule-bound British or Australian systems. At ISB, he had the liberty to choose his electives, to study what he was actually passionate about, and crucially, he had the freedom to fail.
Though it's important to note he never planned on failing. And here is the paradox of his journey. Because he had endured the intense, forced self-discipline at UWC and the absolute misery of Mount Eliza, he actually possessed the internal maturity to handle the extreme freedom of ISB without going off the rails.
He'd been forged in the fire.
He knew how to work. Now he just needed the space to do it. But simply getting into the senior class was a massive high-stakes negotiation.
Right. He doesn't just walk in and get handed a schedule. The administration at ISB looks at his wildly fragmented transcripts. He's coming from the middle of year 11 in the Australian system. He's missing crucial American curriculum credits. And their immediate logical conclusion is to hold him back an entire academic year.
Which would be devastating to his timeline. But Taras refuses to accept that outcome. He requests a meeting, looks the administration directly in the eye, and makes an audaciously bold promise. He promises them that if they let him into the senior year, he will be their star student.
Just massive confidence.
He slides his excellent GCSE results from UWC across the desk to prove his capability. He tells them he will do whatever it takes to catch up.
And when he says whatever it takes, he is not exaggerating. He negotiates a brutal schedule. He voluntarily gives up every single one of his free study periods. The average senior student at ISB takes 6 subjects a semester to allow for homework and socializing.
6 is normal.
Taras negotiates to take 9 subjects. 9. He strategically maneuvers through the curriculum to dodge advanced algebra wherever he legally can, but he still commits to taking IB math and IB physics.
Which is a huge calculated risk. He knows those 2 specific subjects are non-negotiable prerequisites for getting into any respected architecture program. He hates the math, but he understands the game. He just hopes he can rely on his spatial reasoning and ace the non-algebra portions of the exams to scrape a passing grade. And alongside those heavy sciences, he takes a truckload of art and design classes.
He completely rebrands himself. He becomes known around the ISB campus as the Art Man. He is always in the studio designing posters for school events, painting. He starts a pop band.
He's living the dream.
He starts dating a cheerleader. He gets his driver's license and is driving himself to school through the chaotic streets of Bangkok. After the dark, freezing depression of Mount Eliza, he is absolutely thriving in the neon glow of ISB.
It is a period of incredible, explosive growth and self-assurance. But, as is a theme with Taras, that extreme confidence occasionally blinds him, leading to one of the most fascinating, rebellious, and frankly hilarious moments in his entire academic career, the IB physics exam incident.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. You have to remember the context. Taras does not have parents hovering over him, checking his daily schedule or his exam timetable. He is entirely managing his own complex 9-subject education.
All on his own.
And somehow, amidst the band practices and the art projects, he accidentally gets the dates wrong and completely misses the first half of his highly emphasized IB physics exam.
And we really must emphasize the stakes here. That first half of the exam is worth exactly 50% of his total final grade for the year. For a student relying on this specific prerequisite to get into a university architecture program, missing it is nothing short of catastrophic. It should be a moment of absolute panic.
But Taras, operating with an almost absurd bulletproof level of teenage optimism. Doesn't panic. He does the math in his head and thinks, well, it's fine. I missed the first 50%. I will simply go to the second half of the exam. I will get a perfect 100% on that paper, and that will earn me the 50% I need to pass the course overall.
The mathematical hubris is just astounding.
It's amazing. So a few days later, he confidently strolls into the examination hall for the second half of the physics exam. The coordinating teacher sees him walk in and is utterly stunned. The teacher stops him and demands to know why he is even in the room, bluntly informing him that because he missed the first paper, he has been officially deregistered from the course.
Done.
Taras, completely unbothered, calmly explains his mathematically impossible master plan to secure a perfect 100% on the second half to pass.
And you can imagine the reaction. The entire class of stressed out students starts laughing at the sheer audacity of this kid. And the teacher, who takes the sanctity of the IB program very seriously, is furious. He yells in front of everyone, "Who do you think you are? This isn't some kind of examining buffet service where you pick and choose. You are finished here. Get out."
Now, this is where Taras's precise logic and his deep-seated frustration with rigid bureaucratic systems collide perfectly. He doesn't apologize. He doesn't beg for a second chance. He pushes back using a purely technical, legalistic argument.
Oh, this part is brilliant.
He stands his ground and tells the teacher, "My parents paid the tuition for this course and the fee for this exam. I spent an entire year sitting in your class doing the assignments. It is my right as a paying student to pick and choose which part of the exam I want to take. It is even my right to fail the exam if I choose to. But until you deregistered me just now, I technically hadn't failed yet. Therefore, it is you, the teacher, who has caused me to fail."
The sheer logic of it. It is incredibly cheeky. It is immensely disrespectful to the authority of the room. But strictly speaking, he isn't entirely wrong about the transaction of education. The teacher, completely taken aback by this argument, simply snaps back, "Well, it's too late."
And the whole room goes dead silent. The laughing completely stops. The tension is palpable. Taras is standing there, adrenaline absolutely pumping through his veins, and he quickly analyzes the situation. He knows, logically, he cannot win this fight. The teacher has the ultimate power. And in that intense, humiliating moment, who does his mind flash back to? Yes. Michael Liu, years ago in the UWC boarding house, walking away from a physical fight he could have easily won, Taras channels that exact moment of restraint. He realizes that arguing further is pointless and beneath him. So he just smiles at the furious teacher, shrugs, and says, "What do you want me to say? You said it's over, so it's over. Good luck, class."
Mm-hmm.
And he just turns around and calmly walks out the door. It's legendary.
It is a phenomenal exit. But if we connect this to the bigger picture, it is much more than just a funny anecdote about teenage rebellion. Look at the pattern of his clashes with rigid educators. The cleaner screaming at him at Mount Eliza, the physics teacher humiliating him at ISB.
Yeah, it's a running theme.
These negative interactions are quietly, subconsciously teaching Taras exactly what kind of teacher and eventually what kind of leader he doesn't want to be. These specific lessons in the toxicity of rigid authority will heavily influence him when he eventually returns to the university environment as an educator and a mentor himself. He learns how not to treat creative people.
That is a brilliant insight. But in the immediate aftermath, as the adrenaline fades in the school hallway, he has a very real, very pressing problem. He has just walked out of a core prerequisite for his entire future career. He is going to have to creatively find a way around this massive missing piece of his transcript.
And find a way he does, though not in the way you might expect. As his senior year graduation approaches, the daunting reality of actually applying to university sets in. And again, we must remind the listener, this is the pre-internet era. Everything is done via international snail mail.
It's so slow.
It is tedious. It is expensive. It involves carbon copies and physical portfolios. And he is managing this massive administrative burden completely alone.
His transcript is a nightmare for an admissions officer to decipher. Because he took this American-style mix of ISB subjects, missing a core science, it makes it incredibly hard for the Australian institutions, his primary goal, to quantify his grades against their standard metrics. Melbourne University, his absolute top choice, is the hardest application to process.
So he needs a backup.
So as a backup plan, he applies to a few schools in the United States. And listeners, prepare yourselves for this. The art man, the kid who walked out of physics and dodged algebra, gets acceptance letters from MIT and Cornell.
Let that register for a moment. Two of the most prestigious, fiercely competitive, mathematically rigorous architectural programs on the entire planet validate his portfolio, see his raw potential, and offer him a coveted spot in their freshman class.
And how does Terrace treat these monumental acceptances? As safety nets.
It's wild.
He genuinely casually treats MIT and Cornell as safety nets simply because his heart is set on Melbourne University. It's a staggering, almost incomprehensible level of confidence in his own desired path. He knows where he wants to be, and he won't settle, not even for the Ivy League.
But the irony of that confidence hits hard shortly after. RMIT, which is his second choice in Australia behind Melbourne Uni, offers him the chance to sit for a special entrance exam proctored at the Australian Embassy in Bangkok. He is ecstatic. This is his chance to prove himself on his own terms. He shows up to the embassy ready to absolutely crush the design brief.
But he falls into a classic devastating trap for talented, eager creatives. He overdesigns. He tries entirely too hard to impress them. The exam asks the students to design and draw a series of spatial projects. Taurus attacks the paper. He overworks every single drawing, adding unnecessary, hyper-realistic detail, shading every corner, trying to conclusively prove his supreme technical prowess with his drafting tools.
Which is exactly the wrong approach. RMIT at that time was looking for abstract thinking. They wanted to see raw creativity, conceptual bravery, and an understanding of space. They didn't want a human photocopier, they wanted a thinker. Overworking a drawing shows a lack of editing. It shows a fear of white space, which admissions panels often view as a lack of true design confidence. And the result? RMIT rejects him.
The ultimate irony. MIT says yes, RMIT says no, but Taurus, true to his nature, doesn't let the rejection crush his momentum. Now, because the Australian academic year doesn't start until late February, he is left with a massive gap of several months after graduating from the American system at ISB.
A long way.
And this brings us to a crucial defining aspect of Taurus's personality, something you, the listener, can likely learn from. He does not sit idly around waiting for things to happen. Ever.
Absolutely not. He utilizes that gap year with a level of hyper-productivity that is exhausting just to read about. While his peers are likely relaxing on beaches or celebrating their graduation, Taurus goes straight to work. He gets a job at his father's property development company, but he doesn't just push paper. He embeds himself deeply with the professional architects and project managers there.
Getting his hands dirty?
He wants to absorb exactly how real, multi-million-dollar projects are managed, detailed, and constructed from the dirt up. He is getting practical, gritty, real-world construction experience that most university students won't even see until years after they graduate.
And that's not all. He recognizes a massive shift happening in the industry. He sees that the architectural world is slowly, hesitantly starting to shift away from hand drafting and toward computers. He wants to stay ahead of the curve. So he enrolls in the very first AutoCAD course ever offered at Chulalongkorn University in Bangkok. And here is the absolute kicker.
Yeah.
The entire software course is taught strictly in Thai.
Which requires an incredible mental agility. Imagine the complexity here. Early AutoCAD in the 1980s was not intuitive. There were no user-friendly MOIS or drop-down menus. It was entirely command-line driven. You had to type in complex X, Y, and Z spatial coordinates to draw a simple line. Now imagine learning that highly technical mathematical system, but having to mentally translate the complex spatial terminology from English into his childhood Thai just to understand the professor.
It's mind-bending. But by doing this, by forcing himself through this friction, he gives himself a massive futuristic advantage over his future peers. He is learning computer-aided design before most practicing architects even know what it is. It is a brilliant, proactive use of his time while he waits in agony for a response from his dream school, Melbourne University.
Speaking of Melbourne University, late February finally rolls around. The Australian academic semester is literally days away from starting. Taurus hasn't heard a single word from the administration. No acceptance letter, no rejection letter, no request for more information, nothing. Silence.
So what does a normal person do? They call the admissions office or they accept their fate and go to MIT. What does Taurus do? He just packs his bags, flies across the world to Australia, assumes he got in, and walks straight into the university administration office. He walks up to the desk and says, "I'm here for the architecture program."
And what do they tell him? "We have no record of your application. And furthermore, all of our places for the year are completely full. Sorry, we cannot help you."
Brutal. This is the second major stuck door of his life. The first was negotiating his way into ISB's senior year. This one is infinitely more formidable. A major historic university administration telling you to your face that you do not exist in their system and there is no physical room for you. 99% of people would turn around, walk to the airport, and go home.
But Taurus refuses to accept that reality. He starts wandering the empty corridors of the architecture faculty building. He finds a random faculty secretary, pleads his case with absolute desperation, and somehow, through sheer persistence and charm, he manages to secure a last-minute impromptu interview with Jeff Turnbull, the head of first-year architecture, and his associate, Martin Fowle.
This is the ultimate make-or-break moment of his entire life up to this point. He walks into that office, sits down, and he brings out the heavy artillery. He knows he cannot rely on his high school grades. Frankly, with the completely missing IB physics exam and his lifelong struggle with algebra, his transcript is not going to save him. So he presents his UWC CDT portfolio.
His secret weapon, the absolute heart and soul of his creative journey. He shows these esteemed professors his handcrafted cardboard models, his meticulous two-point perspective illustrations done in India ink, and his incredibly early forward-thinking concepts on environmental sustainability, like the house built around the living tree. And the professors are blown away. They look past the messy transcript. They recognize the raw, undeniable creative potential and the totally unique perspective in his work. They see the thinker, not the test taker. And behind closed doors, they do something completely unprecedented for the university. They bypass the rigid admission system entirely. They completely ignore his lack of high school physics and math prerequisites. And they create a special 93rd spot just for him.
Unbelievable.
The faculty budget and space only allowed for 92 students. They physically made a 93rd place specifically for Taurus Wolf. He became the first student in the history of the faculty to ever gain entry based purely on a creative portfolio interview.
It is an incredible triumph of the human will. He outran the algebra equations purely through his creative talent and his refusal to accept a closed door. And once he's officially enrolled, entering his first year, he is absolutely determined to honor that 93rd spot. He acts like an absolute maniac in the design studio. He overdelivers on every single metric.
He does. If a professor assigns a project and asks for it to be drawn in pencil, Taurus stays up all night and does it in permanent ink. If the brief asks for a black and white sketch, he submits a massive full-color rendering. He literally begins submitting multiple, entirely different versions of the exact same homework assignment just to show off his enhanced imaginative ideas alongside the basic required brief.
At first, the professors are completely baffled by this audacity. It breaks their grading rubric. But they quickly realize it's not arrogance. It is just a massive creative overflow. It becomes a known, accepted trait within the faculty. That is just what Taurus does.
But it wasn't all just drawing pretty pictures. His academic nemesis wasn't completely defeated yet. Algebra sneaks right back into his life during his first year, cleverly disguised in a highly technical, compulsory subject called structures.
I love this detail. He thinks he is finally free, he is in art school, and boom, complex load-bearing algebra is waiting for him in the lecture hall. But, true to form, he applies his creative problem-solving. He cleverly evades the absolute hardest parts of the equations, leans heavily on his spatial intuition, manages to barely scrape a passing grade in the subject, and that is truly the very last time he ever has to look at an algebra equation in his academic life.
Finally.
But the ultimate punchline to this entire enrollment saga happens a few months later, doesn't it?
Yes, the timing of this is beautifully, almost painfully ironic. He has successfully completed his first full semester. He is widely recognized as a star student, over-delivering on every project, beloved by the design faculty. He flies back home to Thailand for a brief mid-year semester break. He walks into his childhood home, checks the mail, and waiting for him is an official, heavily stamped letter from the University of Melbourne Central Administration.
Yeah.
He opens it. It is a formal, uncompromising rejection letter. It states clearly that his application has been reviewed and denied, and he has not been accepted into the architecture program.
It's too perfect. He is standing in his living room, holding the piece of paper that was supposed to dictate his entire future, holding a letter telling him he isn't good enough, while he already holds the status of a top student inside their very own faculty.
Yeah.
What does he do? He laughs out loud, walks to the window, and throws the letter straight out into the Bangkok air.
The system didn't stand a chance.
The bureaucratic system said no, but his art, his portfolio, and his sheer, undeniable willpower had already forced a yes. It is the perfect encapsulation of his journey so far.
And as he progresses into his second year, firmly established, we see a profound shift in his actual design philosophy. He develops an intense, almost obsessive interest in architectural minimalism. His design proposals become controversially clean and simple. He starts presenting vast expanses of sparse, unadorned, blank walls. For the listener, minimalism isn't just empty space. It is the incredibly difficult practice of stripping away every single unnecessary detail to force the viewer to focus entirely on the raw fundamentals of the structure, the volume of the space, the exact proportion of the room, and how natural light and shade play across surfaces.
Which is an incredibly bold move when you are a university student trying to impress grading professors. Usually, students want to show off how much they can do, not how much they can take away. But he is fortunate to find a mentor in a professor named Alex Selinich, who fully understands and supports this radical shift. While other, more traditional critics in the faculty thought his unadorned walls were too extreme or even criticized them as looking incomplete, Alex backed him completely.
Mentorship is so key there.
This mentorship allowed Das to safely explore his pure artistic vision while maintaining an unbroken track record of straight A's. Everything is going perfectly. He is mastering his craft. But then, year three happens.
This is a pivotal moment, and it requires us to look closely at the psychological toll of obsession. Taras has an unbroken streak of top marks. He is the golden boy of the studio. He is excelling. And then, out of nowhere, he receives a single bizarre B grade on an assignment. By all accounts from the sources, it is an anomaly. It might have even been a simple administrative error by a teaching assistant. Taras knows with almost absolute certainty that if he walks into the office, argues his case, and appeals the grade, it will be revised up to an A.
But he doesn't appeal it. He just lets it sit there on his transcript.
Exactly. This raises an important question. Why did he let it go? Why did a fiercely competitive student, someone who literally fought tooth and nail in a faculty office for a 93rd spot, just passively accept a flawed B?
It seems entirely out of character.
It does, until you understand his internal state. Taras realizes in that exact moment, staring at that B, that architecture is completely dominating his entire existence. It has ceased to be a passion and has become an exhausting, singular, all-consuming obsession. His entire self-worth is tied to the stroke of a professor's red pen. That B grade forced him to pause and evaluate his mental health. He actually wonders, in the text, if a guardian angel gave him that B just to force him to wake up, to seek a healthier perspective. He realizes that a single letter grade shouldn't have the power to wound his ego so deeply. He desperately, urgently needs balance in his life outside of the design studio.
And how does a hyper-focused architectural student seek that balance? Well, he takes himself out for a meal and a movie, completely alone. And the movie he chooses to watch that night is the classic Australian film Strictly Ballroom.
A fantastic film.
He sits in the dark theater and is utterly captivated by the movement, the passion, the completely non-architectural world on the screen. Inspired, he decides to enroll in a local beginner Latin dance class. He thinks he is just finding a fun little hobby, a physical way to balance the rigid intellectual demands of architecture by day with the fluidity and social interaction of dance by night.
But he has absolutely no idea what he is stepping into. He truly believes it is just a minor distraction, a way to make his design work richer by giving his brain a rest. But as he steps onto that polished wood floor for the first time, a completely different kind of energy starts to take hold. A creatively consuming, intoxicating rhythm begins to brew deep inside him.
And that rhythm is going to turn his meticulously planned straight-a world completely upside down. But we are going to have to leave that wild transition for part two.
That's a major cliffhanger.
So what does this all mean for us today? Let's bring this right back to you, the listener. What do you do when the front door of the system you are trying to enter is locked? When the glossy brochure of your life plan turns out to be a freezing, miserable boarding school? When the physics teacher of your chosen industry deregisters you? Do you give up, accept a rejection letter in the mail, and go home? Or do you creatively, stubbornly find the 93rd spot?
Taras's early years prove a fundamental, vital truth about career trajectories. Unconventional detours, whether it is surviving deep isolation as a child in Thailand, fighting with rigid, unyielding educators, or teaching yourself complex software in a foreign language while waiting for permission to succeed, these events are not distractions from your true path. They are the path. They are the very raw, pressurized materials that forge a uniquely capable, highly resilient professional.
Exactly. The detours are the destination. So here's a final provocative thought for you to mull over today as you go about your work. Think about the biggest failure, the most frustrating detour, or the most painful rejection in your own life right now. Maybe you missed out on a promotion you deserved. Maybe you had to completely change your major. Maybe you feel like you were falling years behind your peers on that predictable pine tree path. What if that detour isn't a mistake at all? What if that specific detour is the exact branch of your own wildly growing Chinese elm tree that is about to bloom into something you can't even possibly imagine yet?
It is an incredibly powerful way to reframe our own professional narratives.
Yeah.
It really is. It changes everything. And listen, you absolutely have to join us for the next part of this deep dive. Because Terris doesn't just learn a few salsa steps as a hobby. He dives in head first. He becomes the highest paid professional dancer in all of Southeast Asia. He engages in actual documented psychological warfare in elite dance competitions. And he does something so incredibly rash, so utterly unbelievable with his hard-earned Melbourne University architecture degree, that will literally make your jaw drop. You will not want to miss it. Thank you so much for taking the plunge into this deep dive with us today. Keep building your own worlds, embrace your detours, and we will see you next time.